From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Why is everybody so angry? My guest Pankaj Mishra looks around the world and sees it not only in the UK of Brexit and the US of Lock Her Up and Donald Trump. He sees it in Turkey and Hungary and India and the Philippines. He sees it in Israel and ISIS and Austria and France. He's writing about resentment. He's writing about a global civil war. This hour on Point, Pankaj Mishra and what he calls our age of anger. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's the root of resentment out there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Pankaj Mishra, author, columnist. His latest book is Age of Anger, A History of the Present. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Pankaj Mishra, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
What's the route you go back to? You go back a long way. We're not talking here just recent campaigns or Brexit or even recent decades. You're going back a century and more. Where are you pointing?
Well, the book is anchored in a historical argument that basically the political pathologies we saw in Europe in the 19th century with the failure of democracy, with uneven economic growth that benefited only a minority, that those pathologies have now gone universal, along with all the political forms that were present in the European 19th century. That includes democracy, that includes free trade. So what we see today, whether it's failed or failing democracies or nation states in Asia or Africa, or whether you look at Western Europe or you look at slowing economies there or grotesquely unequal societies there, they are generating the same kind of pathologies we first saw in the late 19th century. You know, you have demagogues on one hand who are offering a new national community. You have anarchist terrorists who find a lot of young men find in violence a kind of aesthetic and existential experience, and these pathologies are common to people cutting across borders, whether these are Indians uprooted from rural areas in finding themselves lost in the big cities, or people fleeing their failed states or imploding states in the Middle East or North Africa, or you have American workers laid off by an opaque global economy they cannot understand. And in all cases, you will find, you know, people are the frustrated, the humiliated, the marginalized are seeking an enemy they can easily identify. Minorities, immigrants, and women are also special targets of these angry men.
You go back to circumstances there, but you also go even further back to worldviews. And I want to just touch there before we bring it forward. I mean, you've got some observations in here about what's going on now. You talk about collective and individual mutinies around the world, about even the idea of some kind of global civil war that we're in the midst of. But you go way back to Voltaire and Rousseau and views of the world itself and how it works and see a tension there still playing out today. Describe that for us.
Well, I originally actually wanted to start with the 19th century with a figure from Russia, Alexander Herzen, who I quote in the book as saying, you know, modern civilization is a civilization of a minority, and the masses at large are uninvited guests at this feast of life who have to be either excluded or suppressed. This seemed to me a really crucial formulation about the European 19th century with, you know, a lot of application today. But then I felt, as you say, that I had to go and look at some of the worldviews that were formulated in the late 18th century, when really the world we live in started to come into being, and its principles were also then formulated, the principles, the ideals of equality, liberty, the notion of societies held together by individual self-interest. All these ideas were formulated, advocated back then.
The Enlightenment, we call it.
Yes, broadly speaking. The Enlightened obviously contained a lot of different tendencies, but I think broadly speaking, what became prominent starting in the early 19th century as these ideals became institutionalized were, you know, the principles of democracy, the idea of individualism became very important. And we have to remember, you know, these were ideals formulated by people who were escaping older hierarchies of tradition, of religion, of monarchies. They were trying to figure out how to live in this new secularized society. They were trying to build a framework for it. And what the book is trying to argue is that we are facing a universal crisis in this model, that this civilization has repeatedly revealed itself to be, as Herzen said, a civilization of the minority, and it has continuously provoked very severe backlashes in the forms of revolutions, revolts, uprisings. It's a kind of history we've not paid much attention to, and it's a history that in many ways we are reliving today. And in order to understand it, we have to go back to the beginning of the modern world in the late 18th century.
What did Voltaire say? What did Rousseau say? How did they conflict?
Well, I think the debate between them is a crucial one. I was alerted to it by a line in Nietzsche where he said that the debate between them really is pointing to the unfinished problem of civilization. On one hand, you have Voltaire, who's a kind of representative of the ruling classes, the man who believes in you know, freedom of speech, who believes in commerce, who believes in all the things that we believe in, we inhabitants of the modern world, and who's a great critic of religion, of traditional authority. And then you have Rousseau, who resents the prerogative of people like Voltaire to prescribe rules for other people, for other societies. And he's saying essentially that these people in metropolitan Paris who are formulating these sort of ideals for us as we emerge out of this old feudal world of dominated by the church and the monarchy, that this new world of commerce, this new world of self-interest is not going to work out. I mean, I'm obviously simplifying here, but that we need a lot more. We need to really, you know, look at some deep problems and contradictions in this new society that these Enlightenment philosophers are formulating. So the disagreement, the debate between them, essentially, again, you know, simplifying it, is one between someone who's advocating a kind of cosmopolitanism and the other figure is saying, well, that is not going to be enough and that human beings need a lot more than simply, you know, the pursuit of their self-interest or the appeasement of their vanity, that they need different kinds of political communities that includes, you know, patriotism, that includes a very strict sense of who belongs to the community and who doesn't. All these things that are now, you know, that we hear practically every day in our political discourse and what we call nationalism today, these ideas were being discussed in the late 19th century. So in one sense, we haven't moved very far from that particular debate and other debates that were being held in the late 19th century.
But are you really suggesting then that, flash forward to right now, that somehow the resentments fueling ISIS and the resentments fueling Brexit in the UK or Donald Trump's populist rise in the US go back to one root?
Well, they don't go back to one root exactly, but they certainly have, they can be traced back to certain arguments, certain debates, certain conflicts that we have already seen. What I'm trying to argue that, you know, partly to people who feel very shocked and bewildered by where we are today with a Twitter troll in the White House, that a lot of what is happening today has happened elsewhere. It's happened before. It has happened across the world. And we should try and learn, we should try and understand from these specific historical examples what exactly was going on there, what were the issues at stake, in order to understand where we are in the present. This doesn't mean drawing straight lines between the Enlightenment and the present. This doesn't mean saying just because those people said this, this is why we are here today. That would be an incredibly crude way of looking at this. But we have to look at ideas, how they emerged, how they became institutionalized, how they took off in unexpected directions. So it's a much more complex process than just saying it all has one root.
Nevertheless, you make a link, a kind of link globally between these different ripples of resentment that make up this wave.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the last three decades since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the delegitimization of communism as an alternative and of socialism as an alternative to capitalism, we've lived with a kind of ideology that tells us that essentially a rising tide is going to lift all boats and that trickle down is going to happen. This is a sort of ideological fantasy we've lived with, after the end of the ideological fantasy we used to call communism, which our technocratic elites have been retailing, and indeed people in the press and television have been regurgitating that in different ways. But instead of trickle down, we've seen gush up. And today we are seeing kind of toxic political consequences of these really extravagant promises that were made by the beneficiaries of globalization in the last three decades.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a search for the roots of the anger that seems to grip the world right now, a search beneath our current headlines to maybe deeper causes. Pankaj Mishra joins us from London. His latest book is Age of Anger, A History of the Present. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And just open your ears. It's been easy to hear it out there. Here was the President of the United States just at the end of last week talking with the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, appealing to supporters who voted for him because they felt left behind.
The forgotten men and women of America will be forgotten no longer. That is the heart of this new movement and the future of the Republican Party.
Okay, take it all the way back to last summer, Republican National Convention. Chris Christie was talking there. The crowd erupted into these chants, "Lock her up." Anger in the House, and not just in the USA. Terry Greenwood helps run a student information center at Mansfield College, University of Oxford. He spoke last week with PBS NewsHour about why he wants Britain out of the EU.
We should be in charge of our own country. We, not some unelected parliament. You wouldn't have your next door neighbour come in and tell you what to eat at your table. Well, that's precisely what the European Union is telling us to do. It's telling us how to conduct our lives.
Anger here, anger there. Pankaj Mishra sees it in countries around the world. He finds a thread that may run through everything from ISIS to Indianapolis to you name it. Israel, Turkey, the Philippines, you name it. You can join us this hour. Why is everybody so angry these days? Is it just a minority that's pouring its anger out on everyone? Is it more general than that? Is this about people feeling tricked, left behind by globalization or set adrift? And why do so many people seem to want to go back now instead of forward, if that's the way you want to look at it? Pankaj, lots of callers for you and response online as well. And the first thing that everyone's pointing to is inequality. Rick writes to us on Twitter, "The root of societal anger around the world is the same as it ever was, economic disparity." Maureen writes to us, says the anger stems from inequality that is more visible now than ever. And let me get a call, if I may, Ben, for you there in London from New Orleans, maybe on the same theme. Ben, in New Orleans, you're on the air with Pankaj Mishra.
Hi, Tom. How's it going? Great to be on your show.
Great to have you. What do you see, Ben?
One of your writers just pointed out what I was going to say was that the income inequality is what I believe a lot of people are angry. And when people have good jobs and plenty of money, they're usually pretty happy. you know, when they're losing their jobs and they're not able to buy a home and they're not able, they're living paycheck to paycheck, you know, things start getting rough. And sometimes that's why people start acting irrationally and team up with demagogues like Donald Trump, because they're looking for an answer, because they're struggling. And I believe that income disparity reaches, you know, across the globe with, you know, all these other different countries. And in America, that's how we've reacted. And you see how these other countries have reacted in different ways.
Ben, let us pick it up right there. We've got it. And I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Pankaj, how about it? I mean, you've got a big philosophical construct here. Ben says it's pretty simple. It's inequality. It's income disparity.
Yes, I think, you know, if you think about inequality as a presence in human lives through the centuries, you'll then have to ask the question, why now? Why has inequality become or started to have such serious, harsh political consequences? Then I think you'll have to think about what has happened in the last three decades, where we've been promised equality in prosperity. Now, this is a very different thing, where we have a global economic system that basically is promising universal prosperity. So wherever you are in the world, you know, and I grew up in India in the 1970s and 80s, where these extravagant promises were simply not there. You know, our horizons were pretty clearly defined, the kind of jobs we could have, the kind of positions we could have in the world were very clearly defined. But I think what has happened in the last three decades is a kind of explosion of fantasies, of prosperity, of stability. And I think what we are now realizing is that a lot of those promises are unfulfilled, and many of them are unfulfillable. And that those promises can only be realized by a tiny minority. And the rest, the people who feel left behind or who feel pushed behind, they fall victim to, they succumb to these demagogues who come around and say, you are the forgotten people, to quote Donald Trump there. You are the neglected people. You are the people disdained by these elites, these minorities. Never mind that some of these demagogues themselves belong to the plutocracy. But here they are. They've chosen the right political moment to make their intervention and to seduce to many people into thinking that they can sort it all out. And they can restore a degree of equality by how? You know, by actually excluding people who don't seem to belong, by redefining the national community. And this is, again, you know, this is something that has happened before in history, and it is happening again. But I do think that inequality has become such a big source of disaffection and resentment. It's because equality became allied with the promise of prosperity, of general universal prosperity.
But let's just test that for a moment. I can well imagine an economist coming on and saying, well, look, globally, I mean, you talk about a civilization of the minority, Pankaj, but an economist might say, globally, you have more people living out of poverty now than ever in the history of the world. That seems an odd moment. I mean, I get it. I see it. I'm not denying it. But it might, from that perspective, seem an odd moment for all this bitterness and resentment about inequality when there has been a spread for many, many millions of more prosperity than ever.
Well, this is not odd at all. It's only when you have social mobility, it's only when you have a degree of economic mobility, that is when your expectations begin to rise. You know, when I was talking about my childhood in India, what I was trying to say was that there wasn't much mobility there at that point. So you didn't have too many expectations. There weren't too many false promises. It's only when you have a degree of mobility, it's only when you have a degree of economic growth that allows people to emerge from destitution and poverty. It's then you start to actually, you know, aspire for more and then find that your individual assertion in the wider world is doomed to futility, that however you might try to educate yourself or retrain yourself for the new economy, that you're forever being defeated, you're forever being humiliated. That is when political disorder happens historically. It's not when people are poor or suppressed or ground down. It's when there is a degree of mobility, when there is a degree of possibility visible to lots of people. And that is what we are looking at today, that, you know, there has been a kind of global revolution of aspirations, of desires, along with a kind of, you know, this sort of explosion of advertising, visions of the good life that are available universally wherever you are. You know, when I was growing up, there weren't any of these exciting images of the rich world out there. But now every child in poor countries, every poor country in the world is continuously exposed to these images of the good life and naturally wants to be part of it and finds himself or herself frustrated. So, you know, there are problems of blocked mobility, there are problems of slow mobility. And in very rich, powerful countries like America and Western Europe, you now have the prospect of downward mobility. And not just a prospect, but actually a fact. And this is what is causing a whole lot of resentment that demagogues stand ready to exploit.
The confident liberal or maybe neoliberal would say, well, this is just means you need to tweak the system so it works better for more people. Spread the prosperity. Are you suggesting something different, that there's a built-in delusion here about how widely the benefits can ultimately spread? Are you saying take it back to, like ISIS itself in some ways, maybe take it back to a more conservative pre-Enlightenment view of the world? That's your only way to go? It doesn't sound too attractive, Pankaj.
Well, it may not. It may not, because we are so, in a way, sold on this idea of continuous progress. We are so driven by this notion that, you know, we are on this irreversible, unstoppable march, and that nothing will stand in our way. Environmental constraints, all the many challenges that people face around the world in terms of this constant deterioration of their natural environment, horribly polluted cities all across India and China, that all of this does not matter. The political risks caused by this fantasy of universal progress does not matter. What we simply need to do is keep retweaking the system and, you know, find the right kind of technocratic solutions for this problem so that we can resume this march of progress. But I think we're kind of reaching a point, this is something I try and argue in the book, that we really do need to think somewhat differently about where we are and what we could do and where we can go, because what we are really seeing is a kind of massive failure to generalize the lessons of a tiny minority of people in Western Europe and America, their historical lessons, their philosophical lessons, all built upon unprecedented, unrepeatable success. These were the countries that went out early on, conquered new territories, new resources, built political institutions for themselves.
You're talking about the British Empire, about the U.S. for a long
exactly,
time.
Exactly, exactly. These were all achievements built upon expansion, upon imperialism, upon colonialism, upon dispossession. And to think that these ideals of material affluence, of consumption, can also be embraced by people who do not, have never had those kinds of advantages in 200 years, has always been a fantasy. And if we don't want to rethink this particular model, then I think people like Trump are going to be the exception rather than the aberration. I think we just simply...
You mean the norm?
Well, exactly. They're going to be the norm rather than the exception, because this particular political journey that we are on, and this particular model of economic growth that we've embraced, is just guaranteed to produce political pathologies and demagogues of the kind
that you're seeing. Are you suggesting we then go back to, you know, hand out prayer books and get back into tribes?
No, I think, you know, when the question is posed in this way, it is these issues are trivialized. You know, when we talk about these issues in this kind of either or way, that if we can't go forward, if we can't chart a progressive path, then the only alternative is to go back. Well, I'm afraid there is no going back. Mm-hmm. We can only actually move forward. And this going back fantasy is what the demagogues of the world are currently offering. And it's a very treacherous, a very dangerous fantasy. Taking back control, redefining the people, homogenizing populations by excluding the other. And so one should not even speak of going back without qualifying it with these kinds of facts that we can see all around the world today. What I'm talking about is that, you know, all the problems that we see today have been a permanent feature of modern civilization. They've recurred, they've emerged at different points, and they've had to be resolved sometimes by terrible violence, terrible conflict. Progress has been patchy, it's been uneven, it's come about due to a confluence of different factors, very few of which we can hope to replicate around the world. And so it's important to note that these problems have been there. And in order not to suffer from the consequences of those problems, I think it's more important to focus on what we shouldn't do, you know, as opposed to prescribing solutions or universal solutions. You know, people constantly say, so what is your solution? And I say, look, if you are asking me for solutions, it means you haven't actually absorbed the problem deeply enough. If you're thinking I'm some sort of a guru who's going to offer the solution that is universally applicable, then you're basically asking me to repeat or start on a new phase of catastrophic mistakes of prescribing solutions that work for people all around the world, that the pursuit of prosperity can work for everyone wherever they are. All they need is individual aspiration and individual energy. You know, this is the kind of stuff that we've been hearing over the last 20, 30 years. So what I'm saying is that if you don't want to create these huge reservoirs of rage and frustration and resentment, let us not subscribe to this one-size-fits-all solutionism. Let's not believe in this fantasy of universal progress. Let's reject this idea of hyper-competitiveness and vanity, of thinking that society can be ordered like the marketplace. Let's stop importing these values and techniques of the marketplace into our universities, into every aspect of our life. And, you know, I mean, again, thinking about the future, people say, so how do we plan for the future? What do we do for the future? I think it's important to actually focus on energies for the only reality we can really know adequately, which is the present, which is where we live, you know, which is the sphere of existence available to us. And, you know, I think discovering the values of solidarity, the values of trust, trusting other people, discovering the value of compassion, a word that is hardly ever used in political intellectual discourse these days. These are important things, you know, and this book is really concerned above all with the inner life of the individual. There's an epitaph I use from Thoreau in the last chapter about finding reality. And I think, you know, it's because I think the big problem today is a kind of inner disharmony, a spiritual crisis that expresses itself externally in rage and loathing. And I think we have to address this damaged inner life and also realize it cannot be healed by political reforms or economic re-engineering of, you know, technocratic tinkering.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a search for the roots of the anger that seems to grip the world in so many dimensions right now, a search beneath our current headlines to maybe deeper causes. Pankaj Mishra is with us from London. His new book is Age of Anger, A History of the Present. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us this hour. What do you think? Is there something in common between the anger of ISIS and the anger of voters in Britain with Brexit, in the U.S. with Trump, more coming maybe in Europe? Is this about the limits of consumer capitalism to satisfy? And can the anger produce something good? What does it tell us about what we need to do? And I'll go to our calls. Pankaj Thomas writes to us here on Twitter, asks this question: is it useful to pathologize this phenomenon as anger? It seems to dismiss an authentic political movement as emotional excess.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there are all kinds of anger. Anger can be creative. And a lot of artists and thinkers have needed that kind of anger in order to work. But at least what we're seeing today is anger that lends itself to extremely harmful, malign political movements. And that is what this book is about. It's not just simply a case of emotional excess with no consequences whatsoever. Obviously, you know, anger has been around, this kind of political anger, but what we are seeing today is it's very dangerous political manifestation.
You use phrases like collective individual mutiny and global civil war. What do you mean?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of political units, ideals that we have all grown up with, whether it's the church or trade unions and, you know, most importantly, the nation state. What we've seen in the last few decades is that, well, obviously the church really only worked for a small minority, even in, you know, many, many Christian, nominally Christian countries. And trade unions have started to disappear or be undermined long time ago. But now we find that even the nation state, which was a kind of invention to basically, you know, bring together people and define a political community, that itself has been deeply undermined by the global forces of capital, by these very opaque forces. You know, when people today talk about taking back control, what they're basically saying is, you know, let's go back to being the sovereign nation state that we once were, where people in this country took the decisions that affect our life, not the market, not some faceless bureaucrats in Brussels. That's at least how many people see Brexit or the case for Brexit in Britain today. And when I think the nation state starts to be undermined as this sovereign power over people's lives, then you are looking at what, you know, the sort of the people who theorized the state called the war of all against all, where you have really deep, serious divisions within societies. And, you know, in a way, we are seeing that today in the United States, in large parts of Europe, in India, in Turkey, where the one arbiter, the state, is losing, to a large extent, its legitimacy, its credibility, its role as this sort of fair and impartial arbiter between states, between regions, between peoples. And this is really a big problem, because, you know, what the modern world has been built upon are precisely these notions to which we have given reality: the nation state, democracy, which all of which require a degree of consent. But if consent is withheld, if these institutions are mocked, like the media, you know, its public trust in it is at an all-time low. And we know how important an institution, the media, is in a democracy. But we are looking at the media today being mocked by the president of the United States. And a lot of people seem to think he's right. So we are looking at some serious unraveling of certain essential institutions, essential to democracy, essential to the nation state. So we are looking at the conditions. I'm not saying that the global civil war has erupted. I mean, obviously, in some places, civil war has been a reality for some time in failing nation states or failed nation states all over the Middle East, all over Asia and Africa. You can see instances of that. But we are seeing the conditions of a civil war, not necessarily a violent one or a militant one, but, you know, certainly very, very serious divisions and conflicts and polarities emerge within the heart of the modern West today.
Calls for you, Pankaj Mishra from Dearborn, Michigan. Matthew, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you very much. We're talking about anger, and usually anger is brought about by either not understanding or some kind of fear. And I got to believe that the trouble is the doctrine that most people are brought up in, and it's mostly religions around the world, and the doctrine of the modern world should probably be science. But the danger of using science as a doctrine is that we use it as a technique. We don't use it as a doctrine. And by using it as a technique, we bring all this modern world to people, but they have consequences. And I'll just give you an example.
Okay.
You get cars as transportation, but then you have to deal with the pollution problem and all of that. And there's all sorts of other myriad of modern. And modern life is full of, you know, hassles. I don't know how to say it.
But what are we going to do, Matthew? You want to pull the plug on the whole thing? We go back and sit in a cave and...
No. I'm saying we got to go. We need to have science as a doctrine. I would never say pull the plug on the modern science, but we don't have it. Most people wrap their life up in myth and magic and stuff like that. And then when it comes to the tough problems, they're always going back to their God or something like that. And that doesn't help us in a modern world. I don't know how else to put it.
So take your science and go all the way with it, maybe, or further with it. Matthew, I appreciate your call from Dearborn. One more right here from Florida, Hollywood, Florida. Joni, you're on the air with Pankaj.
Hi, Tom and Pankaj. Thank you for taking my call. There's so much I want to say. I hope I'm just coherent and get across a few points.
Go for it.
I sure want to read his book. It sounds really interesting. I think Trump tapped into an organic movement towards building the alternative. I wish more millennials listened to your program and would call in because they were born for these times. But as far as us older Americans, we're seeing the consequences of all these failed systems based upon extraction and predatory practices. That is capitalism. I'm not saying we need to go to socialism. I'm saying there's an alternative out there that's based on cooperation. And when we're looking around right now, what we see are crises, economically, sociologically, all these people being displaced, and most importantly, ecologically, we're in our sixth extinction, and we have a generation coming up that sees the consequences of all these paths that are ready to be on the other end of that scale. You have anger on the one hand that Trump taps into with the demonizing and idealizing and the one right way to do things. And then on the balance, you have action based on responsibility, responses based upon each one's abilities.
Joni, are you ready to check out or to change the system? Where are you looking for relief?
I work with the people that are building the alternatives in communities, which is where we all live, that are demanding citizen advisory boards to oversee the systems until systems can be put in place that aren't reflective of these values of extracting every single resource, be it uranium or be it people's minds and how they think and what they're programmed with and how they're made to feel that if they don't have this, they don't have enough. If they aren't this, they aren't enough.
Joni, we've got it. We've got it from Hollywood, Florida as well, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Pankaj, where are you suggesting people turn here? I've heard you sort of speak not very confidently of the church, to say the least, of the nation state, of trade unions, of the economy, of democracy itself. Look within. Is that it?
Well, I think Joni has a lot of important points too. She just made some. I think she made an important intervention here in refocusing our attention on younger generations. Refocusing our attention on the need to generate new forms of solidarity and definitely new forms of thinking, because and this, you know, resonates very much with the point that I'm making throughout the book, that, you know, the modern project first outlined in the 18th century, the most radical utopian project in history, you know, which basically presupposed the end of all hierarchies and just gave a greater role to individuals with their reason and their
self-interest. Free trade, commerce, reason, and off we go.
Exactly, all of that. I think what we are looking at today is that that project has not worked out for many people today, who as a result want to go back to some imaginary past of collectivism or some fantasy of a whole people with an unviolated tradition. And by the same token, this individualism that has been upheld as this great ideal of the modern world has assumed a kind of extreme form in which no moral prohibition seems to matter. And, you know, you can define your rational self-interest any which way you like. And murder itself can be defined as in rational terms. I mean, this is something, you know, Dostoevsky was writing about long before the anarchist, terrorist and nihilist started their mayhem across Europe and America, and a century before our own terrorists and tweeting and Facebooking and live streaming killers. What I think we are confronted with as a task and as a challenge is rethinking democracy, rethinking particular ways of being with other people in a society. For a long time, we've lived in extremely depoliticized, apathetic societies, and I think a lot of people now feel they have a stake, that much is at stake for the generations to come and indeed for the generations that are alive today, and that we have to be more aware, be more active, and simply, you know, also think of the present in somewhat radical ways, you know, as opposed to just thinking we can basically find technocratic solutions to our present problems, or that Silicon Valley might come up with a solution that will just be, you know, the golden key to all our to all sort of locked doors at this point. So I think this notion of, and which we see now, you know, rapidly being realized, of people spontaneously coming together, forming groups, whether in protest or whether to advance a particular political agenda. We've seen that pretty dramatically across the United States in just this, you know, few weeks that Donald Trump has been in power. And, you know, I do think this is democracy as it should work, not just something left to elected elites in D.C. or state capitals, but actually citizens, you know, building it from the bottom up and reanimating our public sphere and civil society with new ideas and you know, constantly emphasizing the importance of solidarity and compassion. If this can be seen as a political program, why not?
It's a long time since Voltaire and Rousseau were kind of in effect duking it out. I mean, are you suggesting, do you think we really come to the end of that long cycle that goes back to the Enlightenment? Are we really pregnant with something new here, or is this just a twitch on the arc?
Well, it's tempting, given the, sheer scale of problems we face today to, you know, become extremely pessimistic and say that, look, we are basically going through an endgame of sorts. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that makes this bleak scenario look plausible. But, you know, we are human beings. We live through emotions like hope, aspiration, the desire to make a better place for our children, desire to improve the world. And I think it's important to continue to believe in the idea of a better future, even if all the evidence suggests that it is receding from our grasp. It's important to still be attentive to the present. The sheer importance of attentiveness, I think, is something to be emphasized in these very noisy times.
Well, antenna up all over, there's no question about that. You focus us on what may be the roots of some of this, and I guess that's always a welcome thing. Put it in big terms. Pankaj Mishra's new book is Age of Anger, A History of the Present. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Pankaj Mishra in London, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Maeve Pages, Sarah Platt, Allison Poley, Tanya Raleigh, and James Ross. With help from Calvin Henry, Grace Seegers, and Michael DeSocio, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It's good to be back with you. This is On Point.